Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and blessings, and welcome to another installment of the Gist for Freedom of Faith. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities.
Hi, this is Kymie. Do I have Saida on the line?
Saida Garrett is here. How are you?
Hi, Saida. I'm so sorry. I done tore your name up from left to right. I was like,
that's all right. It happens every day.
I know. How are you?
I am painfully fabulous. You know.
Okay.
Well, as in any anniversary of the death of someone you love, it's a very sad and reflective day.
Mm-hmm.
I think of him constantly, like even when I'm not in the mood or have any desire to think of him, I'll be shopping somewhere and this music will come on over the system in the store, or I'll be at a signal waiting for the light to change and someone will pull up next to me and his voice will be coming through the radio, and it's like he's everywhere. He permeates my entire life, and I didn't realize how pervasive his energy and his being and his creative legacy, all the music that he left behind, all the videos and all the visuals that he created for us to enjoy are still alive and still move people.
That is so true. And I remember where I was when I heard the sad news. Can you tell us where you were and what you were doing?
Yeah, it was really weird because I knew Michael to have an issue. Sometimes there were things that he didn't want to do, but he couldn't, like, back out of it, so he had to do it. And I think that the day he passed, there was some issue about there was an ambulance going to his house and there's some drama, but I never thought of it as something serious. So I was on the phone with the bass player from the tour, and we were laughing. We were, oh, here we go. You know, I guess Michael doesn't want to do whatever. I don't know. Whatever. We were laughing. We were hysterical. And then his wife called in. So he said, it's my wife. Let me call you right back. He hung up the phone. I hung up the phone and finished washing dishes, whatever I was doing. The phone rang again, and I had been listening. As soon as I hung up with him, I turned on the radio. And during the time where he was talking to his wife and I was waiting for him to call me back, he called and told me what was happening at the same time as I was hearing it on the radio, and we both just started bawling. We went from laughing hysterically to bawling our eyes out and just, like, rehashing memories of the tour and our recent memories of Michael, and we were just, it was the greatest balance of happiness and sadness in the shortest amount of time that I've ever experienced.
What is your earliest memory of Michael Jackson?
Yeah, well, when I was younger, when he was first starting out with the Jackson 5 and the Jacksons, and I watched the cartoons, I bought bought all the singles and the records and the watched all the videos, and he permeated my life as he does to this day. And my earliest memories of him are, I belong to a family of mostly girls. So I remember growing up, all my cousins, we all had, one of the Jacksons as our favorite artist. And I remember that my cousins had, Jermaine as her husband, and my sister had one of the Jacksons as her husband, and Michael was my husband, right? So cut to, 20-plus years, 25-whatever years later, and I finally got a chance to speak with him on the phone because of a song, that the Man in the Mirror, the song I wrote for him. And I remember in that moment, all my childhood memories of Michael being, like, my husband. I was like, oh, my God, this 13-year-old girl is talking to her childhood husband. Oh, my God. I'm just internally screaming, just going, oh, so excited. But on the phone, strictly AT&T, serious business on the phone, right? So So those are pretty much my earliest memories of. He was everywhere. I grew up with him. Every day, I grew up with him every day, watching the cartoons, listening to the music, hearing him on the radio, watching him on television, you know, because at that time, weren't too many people of color on TV. So every time one of us was anywhere, we were on it. So
I remember. Yeah. Didn't he come on right behind Soul Train? And
yes, yes.
And the Cosby
Saturday
Show.
Saturday
was,
morning, yes, yes.
Yeah, I remember those good old days. And we didn't know how special he was. We knew he was special to us, but at that time we didn't know that he was going to be as special as he became to be to the world. How did you create that song? How did it come about?
I was signed as a recording artist to Quincy Jones' record label. And with that deal came a publishing deal, a songwriting deal. And I wasn't a songwriter, so I wasn't really interested in that part of the deal. And I was signed as in a group, two other guys, and me. I think it was three of us, yeah. Maybe four, I can't remember now. So we were signed. The deal only, like our record deal only lasted a year, you know, and then the guys were dropped. And I was re-signed as a songwriter the following year, and with that deal came my recording artist deal. And the guys were dropped from the label. So I continued to write songs, and Quincy had a meeting at his house, maybe about 6 months or so before he finished the Bad album, and he said, you know, he was talking to a small group of songwriters that were in L.A. that he'd signed at the time. It was like six of us or something like that. And he said, we've been in the studio for a long time, a couple of years with Michael, and we're trying to finish this record, and we need one more song. And he kind of gave us the parameters of the song that he was looking for, and I took notes. And then I called my writing partner, Glenn Ballard, and I said, well, since he's finishing this Michael record, do you want to try and write a song for it? And he was like, let's do that. Let's see what we come up with. So I'm at his house on Wednesday afternoon, and I tell him all about the meeting, and he says, okay, well, let's get started. So he gets up from his chair, and he goes over to his keyboard in a studio, and I'm sitting on the floor with my notebook, my pencil, my cassette recorder, and my lyric book. And so he gets up and he goes over to the keyboard to turn it on. And in turning it on, he starts to play just to get some sounds up, right? So I'm flipping through my lyric book, cut to 2 years earlier. I was in a writing session with an amazing jazz pianist named John Beasley, and we were writing serious into our writing session, and the phone rings. And instead of letting the machine pick it up, he picks up the phone and starts this benignly casual conversation. Oh, nothing, I'm just here. And I'm flipping through my book going, no, he didn't just say, oh, I'm just here. I'm not doing nothing. I'm just seething, flipping through my book. And he's on the phone and he says, oh, yeah, the man? What man? Oh, the man in the mirror. I wrote down the phrase, man in the mirror. 2 years later, I'm at Glenn's house. He gets up, he starts playing. Just to get some sounds on the keyboard. At that moment, the phrase, man in the mirror, popped out at me. And in that instant, I could not write the lyrics fast enough. I couldn't get it out. I was holding up an imaginary stop sign to Glenn with my hand, like, stop, just a minute, hold it. I couldn't write it fast enough. And every time I tell the story, I get goosebumps because the feeling comes back. And I'm writing as feverishly as I could. And in like 10 minutes, 12 minutes, we had the first verse and the chorus of the song. And then Glenn said, well, let me finish the track, and you go and finish the lyrics. It's Wednesday. He said, let's come back on Friday and do the demo. So Friday afternoons on 3 o'clock, we do the demo. We're done at like 6:30, 7 o'clock. Quest Music Publishing is closed for the weekend. It's Friday at 7 o'clock. So I don't want to wait till Monday to turn in the song and then have Quincy get back to me whenever he did. You know, I didn't want to go through that. So I called him and I said, Q, Glenn and I have written this song for Michael, and I really just want you to hear it. And he says, well, I'm in a meeting right now. I got, you know, 12 people sitting in my dining room. I can't. So why don't you just drop it off at the office on Monday? I'm like, Quincy, I can't. I could tell I was frustrating him because he knew he had to get back to these people at his dining room table, and he's on the phone arguing with me about how he can't see me right now, and I'm arguing with him, but I don't want to see you. I just want to give you this. Just let me. And he was like, all right, shit. And he hung up. So I go to his house, and I knock on the door. Housekeeper opens up the door, and she goes to get Quincy. He opens the dining room door, which is across the foyer from the front door. The dining room door is open, and inside I see 12 suits sitting around his dining room table, and they are looking at their watches and then looking at me like, what the hell? What now? What? You know, like, what is she doing here? We're handling some big business here. Why is she, you know? So they're looking at their watches, angry at me that I'm interrupting this meeting. And Quincy takes the cassette, and I said, Q, the only thing I ask, the only thing is that you just let me know, you know, one way or another, just let me know as soon as you can. He's like, all right, shit. And he closed the front door. So I go home, and I'm chilling in my kitchen making dinner or whatever it is I'm doing. And he goes, this was like 2 or 3 hours later. He says, Sid, this is the best song I've heard in 10 years. And I'm going, yes, yes, yes. And then he says, but, and you know how when Charlie Brown's teacher talks to him and he knows that she's talking to him, but all you hear is like, wah, 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 wah. That's kind of like what I was hearing, everything after the word but, you know?
Right, right.
I heard him say something about, we've been recording, you know, we've been in the studio every day for almost 2 years. Michael has yet to record a song he didn't write, blah, 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 blah. He said, don't worry, though. If we don't do it on this record with Michael, I will do it on my next record, Back on the Block, with James Ingram. And I love James, but come on now. Michael Jackson, James Ingram, come on. So I said, all right, whatever, you know, had to let it go.
I can see why you're an excellent writer, because you tell a wonderful story, and Kymie is on the line, but I don't want her to interrupt your story, but I just want you to know she's on the line. So she's going to take over from here. Please resume. So you had to choose between Ingram and Michael Jackson. Go ahead.
Yeah, that was the option. If, you know, Quincy said if Michael doesn't like it or doesn't want to record it, then don't worry. I love the song. I'll do it on my record with James Ingram. I'm like, okay, whatever. So a couple of weeks. A week or so later, I get this call, and Quincy says to me, we in the studio recording your old piece of song, right? And I'm like, yay, yay! And then he said, but, and then again, I don't want to hear what comes after but, because I'm still relishing in the fact that he is in the studio with Michael Jackson recording my song. I just want to live in that for a moment. Let me just have that for a moment. Let me just take that in. And he was saying, but Michael has a... Michael thinks the chorus is too short. He wants four more lines for the... And he says, hold on a minute. And then I hear... And then Quincy says... And Michael says, you really got to bring the story home. You really got to... Hold on. And then I hear... And Quincy says, hold on, Sid. And he hands the phone to my childhood husband. Okay? So... Michael gets on the phone, and he says, hi. And I go, hi. And he goes, I love your voice, and I love this song. Okay, like I was telling, I think her name was Leslie. I said to her, pardon?
We're here. I'm here.
Okay, yeah, I said, the moment I heard his voice, every childhood memory of him being, you know, my boyfriend, my husband, came flooding back to me. And internally, I am screaming, oh my God, I was a complete fan, right? But on the phone, strictly AT&T. Hello, how can I help you? Right? So he says, you know, I love your voice, I love this song, and I just think that the chorus is, it's four lines too short. We need four more lines and blah, blah. So he begins to tell me what he would like to be said in these next four lines. And I don't know where I got the audacity to have this thought. The moment he said he needed four more lines, all I could think of is if he writes them, then he'll be a third writer on this song. I mean, I love the fact that he's doing it, recording it for his record, but if I have an option, I don't necessarily want him to be your writer on this song. So,
which lines did you add on the song? This is Kymie, by the way. I don't know if you know if I'm back
hi.
On.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you. The original chorus was, if you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself and then make a change. That was it. I wrote 6 different stanzas for the second half. And the one that ended up is, of course, you got to get it right while you got the time, because if you close your heart, then you close your mind. And that's what he ended up recording.
Okay. Okay, and as a writer, as a for publishing rights, you get the credits for that all the way through the times, correct? Which is what most writers want to do.
Well, as an unknown, I wasn't even a songwriter when I met Quincy. I had no track record. I had no singles that I'd written and were recorded. I had nothing. So when I was offered the publishing deal, it was all-inclusive. I owned my writer's share and Quincy owned the publishing. That was the deal. I'd been signed to him for 2.5 years before I'd written anything, and he was still paying me for 2.5 years.
Okay.
So Glenn and I split the writer's share, and I'm sure Glenn splits the publishing with whoever he was signed to at the time. And that's how it ended up being.
Which is fine, because it just put you on the map at that point.
Maybe, I'm trying to tell you. I went from
That was just, I mean, some people will lose deals because they would now, usually right at the point when the deal's about to happen and people say, okay, now I'm here. No, I want to change the original agreement, and they blow the whole situation. But, you know, you were wise enough to say, this is so much bigger than.
Yeah, well, Quincy and I were friends, and I didn't even go that far in my mind. All I knew was, I don't want to make him mad. I don't want to have him upset with me, and then I won't be privy to anything. He won't invite me into anything. So
how did you meet Quincy? Because you call him Q. Only his friends call him Q. So you are his friend.
I've known him for many years, and he introduced me to the world as a songwriter, you know. So I forgot the question. As soon as I started talking, I forgot the question.
How did you meet Q?
Oh, it was an open cattle call. You know, Music Connection magazine had a notice that said, you know, Quincy Jones is looking for singers. He really wanted, he told me later, that he was looking for the new Fifth Dimension or the new Manhattan Transfer. He wanted 5 people to, you know, both guys and girls, and he wanted that to be like the new thing. What he was really looking for was Take 6, but they hadn't been discovered yet, because that's the sound that he was trying to create with this group that we had. So that's how I met him, and he told me that like over 800 people showed up that day, and the night before, I didn't even know about it. I got a call from the boyfriend of a girlfriend of mine who was also a singer, but she did not tell me about the audition. She told her boyfriend, and her boyfriend thought that I should go. So he called me that night, and he said, you know, Quincy's having these auditions, and, you know, my girl is going, so I thought this would be good for you too. So he didn't know what time it started. He just knew where it was. So since I didn't have a time, I was in line at 7 a.m. It was me and 2 other people. By noon, the line was around the block.
Wow.
So I'm in this building at FIR they were having this orientation, all these people, and there was a conference table, and on the table were 5 sheets of paper where you sign your name and the time. You got in 10-minute intervals with an hour break for lunch for the next 5 days. And I'm thinking, I'm here now. I'm ready to audition now. I'm doing it now. So Quincy told me that because I was seen very, very early on, I told you I was number 3, because I was seen very early on, they ended up basing a lot of other performances on mine. So I kind of set the bar.
Right.
And I was really happy about that because it gave me a distinct advantage. And I auditioned, and then for the next 9 months, I would get these letters. Congratulations, you're one of 500 for the Quincy Jones, blah, 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 blah. A couple months later, congratulations, we're down to 250, you're still in the running, blah, blah, blah. Congratulations, it's 100. Congratulations, we're down to 50 people. Congratulations, it's 25 people. Congratulations, 9 people. Congratulations, 5 people. You want to fuck? And so it was 5 of us, 4 of us. Ended up being 4 of us over 9 months. During that time, at the auditions, there were tons of traditional songwriters like Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil, who wrote Through the Fire for Shaka. Franny Goldie and Dennis Lambert, who wrote Don't Look Any Further for Dennis Edwards. Just lots and lots of songwriters were in the building, and Quincy was also recording Patty Austin's album. So all these songwriters were submitting songs to Quincy for Patty. And because I was this new demo singer that they met at the auditions, I was singing everybody's demos. And Quincy kept hearing my voice. Every time a songwriter turned in a song, I would be the lead singer. He'd ask the people around him, who's this? And every time they answered him, that's Aida, that's Aida, that's Aida, that's Aida, wow, you know. So my name kept coming up. And
right.
Because I met Dennis Lambert and Franny Goldie at those auditions, I did a demo for Don't Look Any Further.
So it was almost like you were an overnight success in many veins of thinking. I mean, you kind of
so, yeah, underground.
Was
the yeah.
right situation.
Seriously underground.
At the right time.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's what it looks like right there. But I'm sure before you got to that point, years before you even met Q, as you state, and you were doing things and writing things. But from the moment you met and went on that first audition, it was like a 9-month span, and you were just, and then you were put with Michael Jackson.
Yeah, yeah.
That's
it sort of
that's
led to
like
everything.
Almost unheard
yeah.
of.
Yeah, yeah. I was very, very blessed to be in the right place at the right time without even knowing. If that man hadn't called me and said, by the way, you know, my girl is going to these auditions tomorrow, you should go. If he hadn't made that call, I don't know where my life would be right now. I'd probably be somewhere going, can I file that for you? You know, some shit like that. I don't know. It
right.
would be ridiculous. So
when you did the song "I Just Can't Stop Loving You," what was going on in your life? Was there something more meaningful? Was there something more more meaning behind the song than the surface?
Well, the song came to me because a few days before it recorded it, we were in the studio recording this choir for Man in the Mirror, right? And we spent the whole day recording all the vocals for the song. It's really a duet between Michael and I until the choir comes in, because every voice you hear, who am I, do they lie? All the choruses and all the harmonies, it's just me and Michael until the choir comes in at the end. So
right.
who
was,
the,
was it like a, what kind of choir? Was it a name choir or just you had people
it was
in the background?
Andre Crouch's choir. He brought in like, you know, 16, 20 people.
Okay.
Oh, that was a powerful day. Oh, all the voices.
I'm sure.
Oh, it was amazing. It was so amazing. So we spent, you know, the whole day doing that. And at the end of the day, we weren't finished. So he called me back 2 days later, and I'm thinking I'm going to the studio to finish the recording. And so I walk in, and there's nobody in the studio. The last time I was in the studio, was, like I said, it was 20 singers and Quincy and Bruce Sweden, the engineer, and just, it was tons of people. So I go in a few days later, and it's nobody. It's me, Quincy, Bruce Sweden, the engineer, and Michael. And I was like, okay, well, maybe, you know, maybe they're running behind. I don't know. So I'm sitting in a chair behind the console where Quincy and Bruce and Michael are sitting, and I'm just sitting in the chair knitting, you know, waiting for, you know, me to be up. I don't know. So I'm knitting, and Quincy sort of talks to me over his shoulder and says, Sid, you like this song? And I sort of listen to the song from him. I'm like, yeah, yeah. He said, can you sing it? And I'm like, yeah. He said, well, go on in there and see what you can do. Michael, go on in there. oh, Lord, I'm going into the studio, and Michael is following me, and I see, once we get inside the studio, I see two music stands, and on each stand is a music sheet, and on the music sheet, I Just Can't Stop Loving You, Michael Saida, Michael Saida. And at that moment, when I looked at the music sheet with our names on it, that was the instant that I knew, oh, my God, I'm doing a duet with Michael Jackson. Oh, my God.
Okay, hold on. You're going too fast. That wasn't the first time you met him, though, right?
I met him a few days before when we recorded the choir.
Yes.
I was with him earlier that day where we recorded everything up to where the choir comes in.
Okay,
we recorded
this time
the whole
it was
song
just a little bit more intimate because it wasn't as many people.
No. When the choir came, Michael and I were done. Michael disappeared.
Okay.
And so I was downstairs with all these people and the choir, and he was gone. He was not in the studio recording with the choir.
Okay. Okay. So my question is, when you first were excited, but you were calm on the phone,
mm-hmm.
but you were inside, you was like, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. Okay, so you had that, and then when you first were in the room with Michael Jackson,
okay.
What did you feel and what did you do?
I did not want to be a sycophant. I did not want to be that I'd seen girls do when they met him my whole life. I did not want to be that. And I knew that would be some different shit for him. So
right.
I was just about trying something different. So,
right.
I met him and he was just a guy. And the beauty, this is the most beautiful thing that I discovered about him. He has the ability to make you feel like he has as much to learn from you as you do from him.
Wow. Wow.
And that was a real gift that he gave me, because I'm like, oh, my God, this is my
question. Which on some level is true, because he's obviously open to learning who you are so that you guys could have a collaboration in music. And sometimes
yeah,
if you close, there's no harmony and no vibeness. But if I sit here and I'm open and I'm listening to you to learn you, then guess what? I'm kind of feeling your spirit, which brings me to your name. What does your name mean? Is there a meaning behind your name?
Yeah, it's a Persian name, an Arabic name, and I was given it to mean shining and star-like. That was the definition of my name that I was given. But Persians that I've met all over the world along the way have told me my name means everything from happy to smiling or something like that. But it was the same thing to me. So I kept it, and I love it.
Shining and starlight.
Yes, ma'am.
Which is not a question in my mind of how it relates to when you met Q, and then 9 months later you're in the studio with Michael Jackson.
Girl, you know what? I didn't even think about that. I've never thought about that till you just said it.
Oh, that's all. Your names have a meaning behind all of them. That's all right, why you have to watch what you call yourself and how you name
and
your
what you call your kids.
That's
and what right.
You, right. That's right.
That's right.
So I was just curious about your name because it's so different, and it just matches. I mean, how many people can you say woke up, met Quincy, was in the studio? That's just a handful of people that can do that, have done that.
I guess you're right. I'm glad to
right?
be one of them.
What is your actual birth name?
Deborah.
Deborah.
Which is
okay.
a beautiful name, but
yeah.
No one ever called me Deborah. It was Debbie and Deb and Dee and Deborah. It was never Deborah, which is my name. So,
right.
And then I looked it up one day, and it's Hebrew, and it means the bee. So I went to my mother. I said, Ma, Hebrew. B as in Bumble? Like, what? So at 13, she allowed me to change my name because I couldn't stand it. And at one point, once she decided that I really had a problem with the name, and she let me choose the name as a gift to get me out of public school and send me to a Muslim school. I was hating the idea, and she said, "Well, if you change your name, then I'll let you, then you can not go to public school. You can, if you go to this school, I will let you change your name. That was it. And so I said, yeah, and that was it. So from 13, whenever someone would call me, if they didn't call me Saida, I didn't hear.
Well, you know what's interesting is the first name, to be, you took it as a bumblebee, but if you put it together, it's to be shining a star light.
Oh, my God.
No matter how you put the name, what's meant for you is meant for you.
You go,
right?
Girl.
But sometimes you don't catch that. You're thinking a bumblebee flying around, but I see it in a whole different light.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing. The meaning of the name Deborah means the bee, lover of the sweet things in life.
See?
And I told my mother, I said, what's wrong with that?
Right.
Nothing wrong with that. And I said, she was like, there's more than just sweet things in life. You can't just love only the sweet things. I'm like, why not? I never
understood why
I couldn't
do that. Were you a Muslim?
We became,
was that your religion?
Yeah.
Okay.
At 13, my mother, you know, found this man that she really decided she wanted to be with, and he was Muslim. He was FOI, Fruit of Islam. So that's how Islam was introduced to me.
Okay. Okay. And Michael was Jehovah's Witness. Did he go and study Muslim history or something? I thought he had some connection with that, because it just seems like the connection between you two is even more deeper on a spiritual level.
Well, I didn't know that he even had any idea about Islam. And then when I went to the funeral, like FOI, I was sitting literally the next row, one seat over from Minister Farrakhan. So that's when I, and all his security was at the end. It was all, you know, FOI.
Exactly.
So I didn't know that when I met him. I had no idea. But he had just, when we were recording, when we recorded Man in the Mirror, I spent a whole week with him, because we then did the duet in three languages, English, French, and Spanish. So I spent like a week with him all day, every day, having lunch. And, but, you know, we were all hanging in the studio just doing our thing for a week. And I knew then that this was a really special time. So I was in the moment. I was enjoying every second and loving it.
And how has the experience changed your life from that?
Are you kidding me?
What do you see that has just been an extreme? Because obviously not just career-wise. Something must, you can't go into a room of someone so powerful, so spiritual, so talented, and you're talented too, and learn and glean from him, and on some level now you're a little bit more humble, or now you're a little bit more professional, or now mm-hmm. you're a little bit more something that was added to you. How are
mm-hmm.
other things added to your life from that experience?
This experience has changed my life in such a profound way that I can't imagine what my life would be without having had it. And when I think about my story, it's really amazing. I could not have planned for this to work out any better for me. I was introduced, overnight, I quickly became this city's, you know, preeminent demo singer to a songwriter.
Right.
I didn't realize that until Barry Mann and Cynthia Wilde. Cynthia Wilde called me, who wrote Through the Fire, the demo of which I did, by the way, for Shaka. She called me one afternoon. She said, Saida, I just heard the song you wrote for Michael Jackson. And she said to me, honey, you are no longer a demo singer. You are a songwriter.
Mm-hmm.
And when she said that, it was so profound to me. I felt like I was like, yeah, yeah. And then I remember from that moment on, every time I signed an application for an apartment or for a credit card or for anything, and it said occupation, oh, my God, I was able to put songwriter. What an amazing thing.
Right.
Great.
Right. Right. Now,
it's better than singer, you know.
Well, it's both, because now you're a total package.
It's
now
true.
You're a songwriter, now you're a singer, so now you're becoming a total producer that you
yes.
can do, you know.
Yes. And the more you can do and do well, the more you're worth in this society.
Right. That's absolutely right. Now, did you communicate with Michael after the project? Did you, you know, every now and then talk to each other or?
Yeah, I toured with him for a year and a half. Saw him every night.
Oh, okay.
Every night on stage. And there, I have to tell you, he's, as you know, an unbelievable entertainer. And I toured with him for 16 months, and there were some nights. He was on point every night. The audience would not be able to tell that he was better some nights than others. But there were some nights, y'all, where all of us on stage, after watching him do his thing, when the audience was clapping, we were like, shit. We had to clap. We were clapping for Michael, too. Like, you better go. He just amazed us. He amazed us.
Right. And through the years, as you heard, all the, you know, he's been attacked from left to right and so forth, and we don't have to go into those types of things. But how did some of the things affect you emotionally and spiritually, and then you heard of his death? How did that affect you?
I just thought it was such a sad ending for a brilliant, brilliant career. I just felt that it was, that all the drama that went along with him being who he was kind of took away from his musical genius to the world, not to me. Because I was asked like 4 days after he passed to say something at this church that I was frequenting for a minute, Agape. And they said, you know, we're doing this tribute to Michael. He died Thursday. This was Sunday. So we would like for you to sing Man in the Mirror, the choir has been rehearsing it, and we would love it if you... So I said, yeah, I'll do it. That whole, from Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I was getting phone calls from Channel 2, 4, 7, 11, CNN, NBC, MSNBC, Hollywood Tonight, Entertainment Tonight. All these people were asking me what I had to contribute to this frenzy about Michael Jackson. And I remember saying on stage to the congregation, I have nothing to add. I'm only a lover of his music and of his artistry and his creative talent. I have no input on all this drama.
Wow. Before you performed with him, did you see him in concert? Like, did you go to his concert?
No.
No.
No, I'd never been. Mm-mm. No.
Okay.
Unfortunately.
Okay. Now, have you written a book?
No.
Okay. That, maybe you need to write a book.
I got more living to do, so.
Hmm?
I got much more living to do. I got other stuff to do.
I'm thinking a book about some of the... See, a lot of people, for Michael, see what we see on TV
mm-hmm.
and what we've heard, but we've never seen the relationship and the little things that you've experienced with him in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that is just a thought, something, I mean, 9 months to go from Q to Michael in a hit song. There's a story in there. That might be something that you might think of, because people, just like I'm asking you questions, you could write about that.
Yeah,
and talk about that. Because it's more about you at that point. It's more about, because you're going fast. You're going from, like you said, like you were stating, you are like a, not even actually the singer, but now you are a writer-singer. Now,
right.
And you were just kind of put in there, so therefore you went through mental changes and emotional changes of happiness, of greatness, of, you know, all kind of different things. So that would be really interesting, you know, for people to read and learn, especially those that are going into becoming a songstress and writing music and so forth.
That's a good point. I'll consider that. But Quincy's writing a book right now that's coming out soon, so I'll have to wait for that.
Right. And after Michael, what happened next after Michael? After you did the touring with him, what did you do next?
I continued writing songs, and you know I've written a couple of songs that have garnered me Oscar nominations, and I just continue about going about the business of doing what I do, as I always have.
Okay.
The next thing on my plate is a new album for me, because when he passed, I was bombarded, literally bombarded, emails, voice messages, letters, text messages, phone calls out the wazoo. Everybody asking me, you know, how am I doing? How do I feel? Am I okay? You know, with all this that's been going on. And sometimes when I talk, I lose track of what I'm. What was your question? I'm sorry.
Well, basically, after Michael, after the tour, then like, did you now start doing more writings for other people? And
yes, writing for other people and. Just writing for other artists and for their albums and writing for film and television is what I've been doing. And I've been really blessed. I've been nominated twice, once for writing Love You, I Do for Jennifer Hudson in Dreamgirls, and then with Sergio Mendes, a song I wrote in the movie Rio with Jamie Foxx.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Okay. And Dennis Edwards, who is Dennis?
Okay, you remember when I told you that I met these songwriters at the auditions? Two of them were Dennis Lambert and Franny Goldie. They had this song that they needed someone to sing, and so I went and I sang this demo. When they delivered the song to Motown for Dennis's first solo album project, this song was meant to be a duet between Dennis Edwards and Chaka Khan.
Okay.
But they could not get the two in the studio at the same time to get it done before the record was due to be released, and so they gave the song to Motown with me on it, me and Dennis. They were like, we can't find Chaka. Who's this thing in the demo? Saida Garrett. Fine. Put her on it.
That's
awesome.
How
that came
to. You are really the real deal.
I'm trying to tell you.
You are the real deal in the quiet storm. I mean, you really are, and you don't know all the different things that people are doing behind the scene, and look at all the things that you've accomplished even afterwards. What are some of your future plans?
Finishing this album that I've been working on for the past year, I'm nearly done, and all Michael's fans are the ones that sort of encouraged me to do this, because I was out of the being a recording artist. I just wanted to write for film and TV and for other recording artists because I don't like touring. I've toured with the best in the world, Madonna, Quincy, Michael. Hated it. So, hated it. Couldn't stand it. It's a gypsy lifestyle, and I'm a Cancer. I like being home. I'm a home person. I like my creature comforts, you know. So touring for me was a hardship. So, and I did it for a year and a half in the best way possible. I mean, we flew everywhere. Michael put the band and the singers and the crew. We had the plane. But most tours now are bus tours, which are just saying it makes me cringe. I'm busy doing what I have to do to keep my creative process alive and my energy in that area alive. Oh my God! Unfortunately, I have to go. I have a 3:00.
Okay, well, you know what? We are just really, really so excited that the real deal has come on. You are definitely the wind behind your wings that have been flying.
Thank you. We would love
for you to come back and talk about Madonna, and especially if that was the time when she was with Dennis Rodman, and come back and talk about your new album.
I was with Madonna after her issue with Rodman. I was on the tour. I was on the Reinvention tour, and she was happily married, and she just had Rocco, so she was.
Oh, okay.
She was good.
Okay. And then, but definitely, we definitely want to hear more about your new album. Tell me this. Give us a website or someplace that people can get a hold of you, because you have to go.
Saida.com. SIEDAH.com.
Okay.
And you can follow
me
on Twitter at Saida.
Okay. Spell that, please. SIEDAHGARRET.
That's right.
Well, you know, from Leslie Jest and the Jest of Freedom and Black History and Urban Lifestyle Magazine and KRPR Media and Kymie Rochelle, we just thank you so much. You are just so open.
And
you're so humble.
Thank you too, ladies.
You are
Thank
just
you.
Awesome, and I look forward. You, what, where are you in New York right now?
Right now I'm in New York, but I live and breathe in California.
Okay, well, when you are back in L.A., I live in California, close to L.A. I look
mm-hmm.
forward to meeting you one time. I would love to come over and just chat with you some more. So just thank
you,
you so much.
And thank you.
Yes, and you have any last things you'd like to say?
Oh, this is what I'd like to say. No matter what the question, the answer is always love.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, everyone, for watching.
You're welcome.
For listening
Thank you.
To The Jest of Freedom. And you could always look me up and go to my fan page at facebook.com/KRPR Firm. Or you can follow me on Twitter at Kimi Rochelle, KimiRochelle. Thank you so much. Thank you, Leslie Jest and The Jest of Freedom. And her new radio station, Black History. She does a wonderful, wonderful job, and she
Yay.
Definitely gets a lot of great interviews in that gives the behind-the-scene interviews of so many great people such as yourself, and it's great because we need to hear those types of things, and you're just a powerful woman, so thank you so much.
And thank you. Have a glorious day.
No problem, and we are out. Bye-bye.
Bye.